KBOO.org/evening news. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. So glad to have you with us. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth. Coming up next, we'll have the Global Citizen International Commentary and an interview with the organizer of the legendary Makers Market, an Asian American night maker in Portland. That's up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov, and I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the past week or so. Here are some of the news items I'll be covering. Close encounters require U.S.-China military talks. Dividing Gaza, an Israeli strategy. And a congressional commission advocates more nuclear weapons. Close encounters between the U.S. and China. U.S. officials have announced that the president will meet Xi Jinping in San Francisco later this month, the first such meeting in a year. No issue is more urgent to discuss than resuming meetings of the two countries' top military brass. The reason is simple. The U.S. and China have had dangerously close encounters in the air and at sea, all occurring in the South China Sea area, at the same time that Chinese military aircraft are almost daily flying close to Taiwan. The Pentagon lists over 180 times in the past 2 years during which U.S. and Chinese jets have narrowly avoided collisions, all due, the Pentagon says, to coercive and risky maneuvering by the Chinese. Whether or not the fault lies entirely with China, as was the case in 2001, when a U.S. Navy intelligence aircraft collided with a Chinese jet, precipitating a crisis in relations, the danger is evident. So is the underlying problem, the lack of military-to-military communications between the U.S. and China, a situation that has existed ever since former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's ill-advised trip to Taiwan a year and a half ago. The Chinese have consistently rejected every U.S. proposal to restart talks. In the past, the U.S. and China have had three channels for military discussions: annual talks between senior officials, the Military Maritime Consultative Agreement on Aerial Issues, and the Defense Policy Coordination Talks on Crisis Management. None of those channels is open now, creating a communications gap that is also relevant to another situation in the South China Sea that could involve the United States: the dangerous encounters between Philippines and Chinese ships in waters claimed by both countries, but which seem indisputably to belong to the Philippines. The Chinese have amassed quite an armada of heavily armed Coast Guard vessels and other ships to block Filipino ships from supplying a sunken vessel on one shoal that symbolizes their claim. Now, two minor collisions have occurred. The U.S. has no territorial claim in the South China Sea area, but it is a security partner of the Philippines and is engaged in joint air and sea patrols there. For a third time in recent weeks, the U.S. has indicated that it will come to the aid of the Philippines if it or its forces are attacked, most recently when the president, on October 25th, invoked the 1951 Security Treaty with the Philippines and said the U.S. commitment to its defense was ironclad. A Chinese foreign ministry spokesperson said the U.S., quote, has no right to get involved in a problem between China and the Philippines. The Philippines leader, Ferdinand Marcos Jr., calls China a bully. Given U.S. involvement in the Middle East and Ukraine, a confrontation with China in the South China Sea is the last thing the Biden administration needs. Military-to-military talks are essential for mutual security. Without them, a violent incident is almost certain to happen. The prospects for such talks have improved with Foreign Minister Wang Yi's visit to Washington last week. President Biden said the two countries, quote, need to manage competition in the relationship responsibly and maintain open lines of communication, unquote. Wang Yi, preparing the way for Xi Jinping's visit, said his goal was to stabilize China-U.S. relations, but he also said that won't be easy. Yet both countries have good reason to avoid a miscalculation in the South China Sea, not to mention in the Taiwan Strait. Dividing Gaza, an Israeli strategy. Naftali Bennett, a former Israeli prime minister, has offered a plan to end the war that differs considerably from anything we've heard. Neither a ceasefire nor pause, on one hand, nor an all-out assault on Gaza on the other. His plan may be a preview of Israel's actual strategy today. In brief, Bennett's plan is for Israeli forces to divide Gaza roughly in half, creating a corridor for Gazans to move south, where they should be provided with humanitarian aid. The military would then seek to isolate Hamas in the northern half, denying it fuel and subjecting Hamas to targeted ground attacks. Cities would not be bombed or occupied. Hamas, Bennett believes, would be driven into tunnels for lengthy stays that might lead to their giving up the fight and to the release of hostages, who would be an increasing liability. Hamas fighters who surrender would be given the option of safe passage out of the country. Bennett believes this plan would greatly reduce loss of life on all sides. The plan has two major drawbacks. First, it's a war plan, not a peace plan. It ignores or avoids Palestinian grievances that are of long standing. The desperate economic conditions in Gaza that enabled Hamas to flourish, the constant expansion of Israeli settlements, the efforts to quash any hope of Palestinian statehood. The plan offers no ceasefire or pause. Second, the plan doesn't address what happens afterward. What kind of authority will be set up in Gaza in place of Hamas? Bennett acknowledges that his military plan may take years to accomplish, and therefore years before the people of Gaza can return to their homes. In fact, as Bennett said in a tweet after publication of his views, he actually wants Gaza to be reduced to the southern half for as long as Hamas is still around. By then, Gaza might be totally destroyed. Who will rebuild Gaza, and who will want to return? What will replace Hamas as the governing authority in Gaza? Increasingly, it looks like Israel's actual strategy is to make at least half of Gaza uninhabitable and, according to a leaked Israeli government document the other day, permanently expel the population. A congressional commission advocates more nuclear weapons. A hawkish congressional commission comprised of 12 members, drawn equally from both parties, has warned that China-Russia cooperation puts the U.S. at risk of a two-front war against both countries. The Congressional Commission on the Strategic Posture of the United States in a report said, quote, the new partnership between Russian and Chinese leaders poses qualitatively new threats of potential opportunistic aggression and or the risk of future cooperative two-theater aggression. In contrast with current U.S. policy, the report says, quote, the U.S. and its allies must be ready to deter and defeat both adversaries simultaneously. The U.S.-led international order and the values it upholds are at risk from Chinese and Russian authoritarian regimes. The Biden administration insists the U.S. already has more than enough nuclear weapons to deter adversaries, and the U.S. has a long-standing lead in nuclear weapon reliability and global deployment. Yet the leaders of the commission insist, quote, we must urgently consider additional adjustments to our own nuclear posture if we are to sustain deterrence against two nuclear peers. The commission uses the old ploy of scare tactics, especially with respect to China. For instance, its report cites the Pentagon's figures that China has increased its strategic nuclear weapon inventory from about 350 to 500 and could have 1,000 by 2030. But that leaves China far behind the U.S. inventory of roughly 5,500 strategic weapons, with hundreds on invulnerable nuclear subs within easy range of Chinese targets. Furthermore, China, unlike the U.S., subscribes to a no-first-use policy, meaning it will not initiate use of a nuclear weapon in a conflict. At sea, the Pentagon report highlights China's growing naval strength, including the launch of a third aircraft carrier. But the U.S. has 11 aircraft carriers that are deployed all over the globe. Given the budgetary implications of the Commission's recommendations, the call for major additional funding of nuclear weapons is unlikely to pass, nor are some of its other recommendations, such as deploying more tactical nuclear weapons in Asia and Europe, deploying some or all reserve U.S. nuclear warheads, and producing more nuclear submarines. But research on nuclear weapons will continue here and in Russia. The Russians have indicated they're revoking ratification of the 1996 Comprehensive Nuclear Weapon Test Ban Treaty. That has led the U.S. to resume so-called subcritical experiments that involve atomic materials with the purpose of better detecting underground nuclear tests. The U.S. and Russia are among several countries that have not ratified the Test Ban Treaty. Others are China, India, Pakistan, North Korea, Israel, Iran, and Egypt. This latest development stands in contrast with U.S.-Russia agreement last February to extend the new Strategic Arms Treaty. That treaty allows for 18 inspections by each side of deployed and non-deployed strategic weapon sites to confirm that they have accurately reported on weapons numbers. In other news, the horrendous body count in Ukraine. Casualties in the war in Israel can be measured in the low thousands, but in the Ukraine war, they can be measured in the hundreds of thousands. According to Britain's defense ministry, 480,000 Russian soldiers have been killed or wounded, which by usual measurements means about 115,000 killed. Interestingly, Ukraine's estimate is lower, 294,000 Russians killed and wounded. Either way, those are terrifying figures. As for Ukrainian casualties, U.S. officials estimated in August that around 70,000 Ukrainian soldiers had been killed and anywhere between 100,000 and 120,000 wounded. Colonialism, Chinese style. Forced labor is an important feature of China's genocide in Xinjiang province. A new Chinese program with a seemingly innocent title, Vocational Skills Education and Training Centers, aims at a more efficient use of prison labor than a previous program. The essence of the new program is intensive re-education followed by assignment to profitable outside enterprises. Uyghurs are systematically shipped off to other provinces and even put on board fishing vessels. How do the Chinese authorities justify forced labor? It's part of poverty alleviation. Labor gives poor, oppressed people something to do, whether by force or otherwise. In Tibet, the Chinese are interested less in forced labor than in forced education, the kind of education that changes children's identity and loyalties. According to one report, Chinese authorities have established, quote, a vast system of boarding schools for Tibetan children that aims to assimilate them into Han Chinese culture and society by cutting off their ties to their families, culture, language, and religion, and replacing Tibetan educational content with political indoctrination. The government has shut down local Tibetan schools, and now young students are sometimes forced to travel hundreds of miles away from home to get an education, unquote. Now, a Tibetan sociologist who has visited many of these schools reports that they hold 800,000 children, or 78% of Tibetan children ages 6 to 18. What China has done is what British, French, and Dutch colonial rulers did in their day. You would think that countries that were once colonies, as well as countries with large Muslim populations, would support the Uyghurs, if not Tibetans. But, as we all know, money and politics talk loudest in international affairs. Despite all the evidence of the most serious human rights crimes in Xinjiang, 70 countries, led by Pakistan and including Palestine, voted in the UN to support China's repressive policies by agreeing with Beijing that what goes on in Xinjiang stays in Xinjiang. Most of the pro-China vote was predictable, such as Russia, North Korea, Laos, Sri Lanka, Gabon, and Solomon Islands, all trade and aid partners with China, and the Central African states, such as Niger, where pro-Russian coups have toppled governments. Overall, the list of China supporters shows that the Belt and Road Initiative has largely paid off in Africa, South Asia, and the Pacific Island states, though not yet in Latin America or Europe. Also relevant to that vote, I mentioned Palestine's support of Chinese repression. These days, the Chinese internet is full of comparisons of Israel's war on Hamas with Nazism. Anti-Semitism is suddenly acceptable on the Chinese Weibo, whereas any sympathetic sentiments on Uyghurs or Tibetans are quashed immediately. Ukraine aligns with Israel, but not the reverse. One might have expected President Vladimir Zelensky to steer clear of commenting on the war in Israel, since he hopes to attract support for Ukraine's cause from Arab states and the global South in general. Or, if he did comment, he might have drawn an equivalence between Russia's invasion of Ukraine and Israel's invasion of Gaza. But Zelensky did not take either of those roads, saying in a speech to a NATO assembly on October 9 that Hamas and Russia are, quote, the same evil, and the only difference is that there is a terrorist organization that attacked Israel, and here is a terrorist state that attacked Ukraine. Yet the pro-Israel comment seems unlikely to change Israel's stance on Ukraine, which is motivated by not wanting to offend the Russians because of their predominant influence in Syria. Finally, so you like squid? Food for thought. Ian Urbina of the Outlaw Ocean Project writes in the New York Times about how squid, aka calamari, rose to become a popular menu item in the U.S., but his real purpose is to reveal the politics of this food. In short, how it is brought to our tables. Most always, squid gets here from Chinese fishing trawlers, the world's largest fleet, which scoop up vast quantities of squid and other fish for Chinese and international consumption. Chances are good that their catch was caught illegally by a crew that was poorly paid or even forced into labor, such as North Koreans assigned by the state, a violation of international law. Before you decide never to eat calamari again, also consider what Ian Urbina says about the positive side of squid politics. Quote, environmentally minded chefs like it because it is one of the lowest carbon emitting sources of animal protein on the planet. Squid are also surprisingly equipped to handle climate change. Ocean acidification doesn't seem to bother the animal. So now you decide. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening. Take good care.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KABU News In Depth. I'm Andrea K. Hendrickson. In partnership with Portland Night Market, Asian American Town presents the legendary Maker's Market, an Asian American night market, and it is happening this weekend on Friday, November 3rd and Saturday, November 4th from 4 to 11 p.m. at 100 Southeast Alder Street in Portland, Oregon. I had the chance to speak with Tom Sollett, creator of Asian American Town, as well as Samson Seahroth, managing artistic director of Theater Diaspora, Alex Chu, painter and muralist, and Billy Soul, aka DJ Good Fortune, all of whom are participating in the legendary Maker's Market.
Hi, my name is Tom Sollett, the creator of Asian American Town and the legendary Maker's Market.
How did the idea for Asian American Town come about?
I think after several years of looking for an Asian American community that didn't exist, I decided it was time to be proactive about this and go try to build it myself. Sorry, that was not necessarily a question, but yeah. So after looking for several years, going to different nonprofit groups, different clubs, different meetups, it looked like there wasn't much cohesion. And I thought it'd be really cool to have kind of a focal point for people to all meet and gather on a regular basis.
How did you connect with Portland Night Market?
So I just came by one night and took some photos and they liked them. And then on a whim, I asked them if they'd be down to do a collaboration and they had a positive response. And to be honest, right away, I was like, I didn't know I could get this far through just direct message on social media. So after just following up continuously since last November, here we are 1 year later. And we've got this incredible event that's about to happen.
How many vendors are you hosting and what was the pathway to becoming a vendor?
So we have over 130 vendors and counting. We're still pending payment on a few. And that's including all of our wellness practitioners, all of our artists, all of the people who are screening their films. They're all small business owners. So they're all out here adding to our collective story. And I think the only barrier that we really had is to ask people why they wanted to join an event like this. And if we felt like their answer matched the intent that we had, it was go. And it didn't matter if they were well-established or not.
Are there any aspects of Asian American Town that you would like to highlight?
I would say the biggest intent we have, or I have, through this project is to provide a touching off point for people, whether they're interested in music, art, culture, food, or just hanging out, is to be able to easily find different community groups or containers for them, whether it's Theater Diaspora for acting, or it's Pop Fever for music, or whether it's just looking for some people to hang out with through a meetup group.
Are you hoping to make this an annual event?
Absolutely. The whole process of getting this event together has been so positive. And as you can see, kind of walking through the space today, it's an incredible excuse to go build relationships with all these talented people that are here. And to see it all come together is just pure magic.
Why is this an important event to host in Portland?
Say Portland has a reputation for being the whitest city in the USA, but we actually have a really large Asian population here. And that's kind of encompassing Asian immigrant, Asian American, transplants, and people that are just here temporarily. But you wouldn't know that just on a day-to-day basis, that we're like 1 in 11 people. But if you start looking for folks, no matter where you look, whether it's in film, whether it's in...
Remember the days of wandering the pumpkin patches in search of just the right one to bring home? Not too big, not too small, but with a little bit of personality? Well, the days of mucking through the chilled autumn air are over. Now you can grab a KBOO pumpkin crew neck or long sleeve that fits just right and keeps your elbows protected from the elements. Pick up an organic, homegrown, community-sourced piece of merch in gray, green, navy, or maroon and rock this autumn in style. Just check out the sidebar on our website at kboo.fm to harvest your KBOO pumpkin apparel today.
Thank you.
Pumpkin patches in search of just the right one to bring home. Not too big, not too small, but with a little bit of personality. Well, the days of mucking through the chilled autumn air are over. Now you can grab a KBOO pumpkin crew neck or long sleeve that fits just right and keeps your elbows protected from the elements. Pick up an organic, homegrown, community-sourced piece of merch in gray, green, navy, or maroon and rock this autumn in style. Just check out the sidebar on our website at kboo.fm to harvest your KBOO pumpkin apparel today.
The following program is a rebroadcast. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred. Thank you for tuning into KBOO Portland.
You're listening to Rose City Native Radio, Low Res Edition. Stick with us as we play you music, throwback interviews, and more. Stay safe, wash your hands, wear a mask, and we'll see you on the other side.